Now, yesterday, the Fine Gael leader and Taoiseach Leo Varadkar set a new target for the building of homes. He told his Ardesh that 40,000 homes will be needed to be built each year. That's double where we are now and a third more than the government target of 30,000. And he said that an additional 4 billion euro, which was put into the health service to help with the pandemic, should be retained there into the future. So are those promises or aspirations? Well, we're joined in studio now by the Taoiseach and leader of Fine Gael, Leo Varadkar. Taoiseach, thanks and
thanks
welcome to the programme.
Afternoon. Thanks for having me.
You say that that 4 billion euro allocated to the Department of Health should be retained there. Is that a commitment now? Will that be happening in the October budget?
That's Fine Gael policy, and it's now our role to seek its inclusion in the budget. So let me explain our thinking behind it. There has been a lot of public spending, a lot of big increases in public spending in the past year because of the pandemic. That was justified. That was necessary. Most of that will have to be withdrawn over the course of the next year. You know, those big ticket items, PUP, cost nine billion, that will be phased out. Employment wage subsidy scheme, a lot of the one-off grants won't happen again, but we think an exception should be made in some areas, and that particular area that we say an exception should be made is health, because we're going to need those additional resources, those extra staff, those beds, that additional money, rather than phasing them out or closing them down. We think we're going to need them because of all of the unmet demand for healthcare that's built up during the pandemic period, and indeed that was there before the pandemic.
Sure,
that's our policy.
It's a big spending pledge to make in the middle of an Ardesh speech. Did you speak with the Minister for Public Expenditure and Reform, Michael McGrath, before you made those comments?
He knows my views on this, you know, because we've had these discussions at cabinet subcommittee meetings. But there's no government decision made on this, and obviously I've spoken to Pascal Donoghue about it, who's the Minister of Finance and has overall responsibility for fiscal policy.
Mm. It's not a government decision, though. So this is just you're just putting it out there as party policy.
It is Fine Gael policy, and very often, not always, Fine Gael policy becomes government policy, and that is what we're going to be working on now. And again, bear in mind what I'm saying. I'm not saying that there should be a 4 billion euro increase in health spending next year. I'm saying that the additional health spending that we had this year should be retained next year. So it's not a spending increase. It's retaining health spending at current levels, not phasing that out. But we will have to phase out spending
areas. That goes into the base, and it would be 4 billion, which would continue on every year.
That's correct.
Afterwards.
And I believe it is necessary. You know, we have enormous demands for healthcare in Ireland, unmet healthcare need. Huge numbers of people are waiting for appointments, waiting on operations. We've fallen behind on things like cancer screening. And I don't see how we could countenance having hired all those extra staff, having opened all those extra beds, having all this additional capacity, having made all these reforms, that we would now say that we're going to wind them back. I can't understand how we could countenance that. We have a bigger health service than we've ever had before, or at least in 20 or 30 years. We should keep that because we need it. We always need it.
Okay, but you also have commitments of around a billion for a MICA scheme, a billion for a redress scheme. We're told we're going to lose probably 2 billion, 2.2 billion in corporation taxes. The programme for government also commits to tax changes, which will cost between 2 and 4 billion, depending on who you ask. I mean, that's over 10 billion alone there, and that's just that short list. So how are we going to pay for all of that additional spending? There's no way, is there, that growth is going to pay for all of that?
Well, first of all, none of that's, or all of that spending doesn't all occur next year. You know, the spending that you outlined there will be spread over a number of years. So it's not that those commitments exist on that scale for next year by any means. What we'll do in the next couple of weeks is we'll set a target for the deficit next year. The deficit will have to come down, of course it does. And that will be done mainly through growth, but also through withdrawing some of those pandemic exceptional expenditures. Like I mentioned, the big ones, the ones that cost the most, like the PUP and the EWIS, for example. And that will allow us, we believe, to get to a deficit somewhere between 3 and 4%, and we'll set that target in the next couple of weeks, and that is achievable. But the heavy lifting will be done by growth. There are some people in this country who have a high tax ideology. They believe the only way to secure additional resources for government is taxation, and they're always inventing new ideas for new taxes. We see it differently. We believe that you can make the cake bigger, and that means enterprise policy, supporting business. It means an industrial policy. It means supporting free trade deals, not trying to block them. It means welcoming investment into the country, not trying to discourage it. And if we make the cake bigger, obviously more comes in taxation. And we can do that. We're going to have economic growth this year of 4 or 5%. I think we can have economic growth of 4 or 5% next year.
And yet you have the Fiscal Advisory Council in its report last month saying that the government's financial projections lack credibility and paint too rosy a picture of the future for tax revenue. And here you are adding more spending, more recurring spending onto that list.
I think what the Fiscal Advisory Council has often said is that we underestimate demographics and the cost of that, a growing and ageing population. And that's one of the reasons why I'm saying we need to be honest about the health budget staying big. It's not going to be possible to, and we shouldn't try to reduce it because we have an ageing and growing population, increasing demands. And I think we should put in our projections, the commitments that we've made to index tax bands to make sure that more people don't end up paying that higher rate. We have the fourth highest marginal tax rate in the developed world, and too many people pay that. So I think they're right on that point. But they're not right in everything. You know, bear in mind, this is the same Fiscal Council that told us that we wouldn't balance the budget, and we did it three times. And this is the same Fiscal Council that told us the economy was overheating when actually we were heading into Brexit, a pandemic and a big recession. So we'll take on board their advice, but they are often wrong.
The shift in the target from 30,000 up to 40,000 homes per year that you mentioned in your speech yesterday, again, it's an easy figure to throw out there, but harder to deliver. And that's not a government target either, is it?
We're developing our Housing for All policy at the moment. That'll be the government's new housing policy. Hope to have it ready in July. Again, this is Fine Gael policy that we'll be feeding into this. I believe it's achievable, by the way. We used to build 80,000 houses a year in Ireland once upon a time, or 80,000 homes a year in Ireland. Our target now is to get to half that.
And will you be making that a government target? Is that your plan?
That's our plan. And bear in mind where we are now. You know, back in 2016, 2017, we only built about 5,000 houses a year. We're up to 20,000 now. That's a quadrupling. Not enough. Everyone knows it's not enough. Can we get to 25 next year, 30 the year after, maybe 35 the year after that, and then 40? I think we can do that. I think we can probably even do better than that. And that's the target that we believe is necessary, both to provide social housing for people who need it, to get off housing lists and to free up more properties for renters and for people who want to buy, but also and predominantly to build private housing, because most people in Ireland want to own their own home. Roughly 65% of people do. We want that dream, that thing to be a reality for more people, particularly people in their 20s, 30s and 60s and 40s. And that's why we set out the target to get back to 70% home ownership in this country.
All right. I want to ask you about developments in relation to the National Maternity Hospital and concerns that have been expressed that it will not be independent of a religious ethos. Can you clarify, first of all, was there a bid made to purchase the site on St. Vincent's where the hospital will be located? Because the nuns and the hospital group both say that there was no bid, no substantial bid.
Well, I think, first of all, it's important to say that this hospital will be owned by the state. That's agreed. And this hospital will provide any obstetric or gynaecological service available in the state to women and to neonates.
And is that legally nailed down now?
Yes, yeah, it is. And it's already the case in Hall Street. And I think there's a little bit of, there are people maybe trying to question that more than they should, because, you know, what's the case in Hall Street now will be the case in the new National Maternity Hospital, and that is all those
things. So why do you have concerns about safeguards then? What are your concerns here?
They're twofold. One is around the ownership of the site on which the hospital will be built. To answer your question from earlier, my understanding is that there is correspondence between the Department of Health and St. Vincent's, in which St. Vincent's in no uncertain terms say that they are not willing to discuss the sale of that particular parcel of land. We want to talk about that. We're willing to talk to St. Vincent's about it, or willing to talk to the Sisters of Charity about it. What the Sisters of Charity are saying, which is very reasonable, is that they're pulling out of healthcare. They're off the board of Vincent's. They're now transferring the land to this independent charity. So whoever we need to talk to about buying the land, we're willing to talk to them about buying it, and we can get an independent valuation done quite quickly. But what is not clear to me is whether they're willing to talk to us about it.
OK, and we'll find that out. And you also have a concern then about governance, about the fact that the hospital directors are not going to be, a majority of them won't be appointed by the government.
As I understand it, on the current proposal for the new National Maternity Hospital Board, none of them will be appointed by the government, except perhaps a public interest director. Now, that actually isn't unusual. We have a lot of voluntary hospitals in the state, you know, like the Mater in Dublin, the Mercy in Cork, where the board is not appointed by the state. But what's different here is this is new. You know, it's a new hospital effectively on a new site. And that's why I think those historic arrangements should change, and there should be government appointees on the board. Whether it's a minority or majority, we can talk about all of that, but the current position is that there won't be any, and I have a problem with that.
Other parties have said that the government should either buy the site, and you said that you will talk about, you will get into negotiations if they are available to you on buying the site. But could you put a compulsory purchase order on that site and buy it that way?
That's a possibility, but it's complicated. That can take years. It's kind of a landlocked site. It's not, it's a site within the wider Vincent's campus, which creates complications too. And the risk of going down the CPO route would be that we might then lose the cooperation of St. Vincent's if we were to go down that route to take them to court to CPO the land. So it's not an option we've ruled out. We would much rather agree a sale, and if they're willing to talk about that, we are too.
And if you can't do that, if you can't agree a sale, or you can, or you're not going to CPO it, and you can't get government directors on the board, will you move on? Will you go to another site, look for another site to build that hospital on?
Well, you know, the very often the perfect is the enemy of the good. And what we want to get is the best possible outcome for the state and for women and for children. If you look at our maternity and paediatric hospitals around the country at the moment, with the exception of CUMH and Cork, they are very old. They're hundreds of years old. We need a new maternity hospital in Limerick. We need a new paediatric unit in CUH. We need to finish the children's hospital, and we need to build a new maternity hospital in Dublin. And if we can do that over the course of the next 10 or 20 years, we will have state-of-the-art facilities for children and for women, having gone from ones that are 200 years old now. And that's a huge ambition. We intend to achieve that.
Okay, but are you prepared, though, to walk away from this if the red lines that you've set out there, if they can't be worked out? I mean, is the government... are you saying to me now that you're going to go ahead and build on that site regardless of what happens?
No, I'm not here to make any threats, and that's not... what this is about. There will be a further engagement over the next couple of weeks with Hollis Street, with St. Vincent's, if necessary, with the Sisters of Charity, to figure out what we can do to get the best outcome possible for children and women in Ireland. And that's what this is about. And I know there are some people who want to have a go at different elements or different groups here. That's not fair. You know, in fairness to the church, the Archbishop wants to come off the board of Hollis Street. They are gifting us Crumlin, in fairness to the Archdiocese of Dublin. When it comes to Sisters of Charity, they're already off the board of Vincent's. They're willing to gift the land, albeit to a charity. So, you know, I'm not here to have a go at anyone. I know there are others who will do that.
Okay, but I'm trying to.
But we will have an engagement.
Okay, but what I'm trying to understand is the option of not going ahead with the hospital on the site of St. Vincent's on the table still?
Well, that's always been an option. You know, neither the government nor the HSC has signed off on the final arrangements. So if we don't, obviously the hospital then can't go ahead on that site. But that would not be a good result. It might satisfy some people who are coming at this from an ideological point of view, that we'd set this back 10 years. I don't think that would be a good outcome for the women and children of Ireland who need this new facility as soon as possible. But there are red lines, and we do have to make sure that we're assured that our investment is protected, that it is publicly controlled, and that any service that's available in Hollis Street currently, which includes terminations and IVF, would be available in this new hospital.
I want to talk to you about the events in Northern Ireland this week and the instability that's there this weekend, and we'll talk a bit about that in a moment. But do you regret now bringing up the issue of a united Ireland during the week, when it was clear that there was a fragile and a volatile position in Northern Ireland as the parties were trying to piece together and put the institutions back together?
No, I don't. And I don't think anyone would seriously argue that the reason why things happened in the DUP this week had anything to do with my speech. Far
no,
from
but
it.
Timing and tact are everything. And perhaps you didn't display that very well this week.
Let me say two things about that. The conversation about unification is happening. Our party, Ardesh, was this week. The theme was the future of Ireland, its place in the world. And I think it was appropriate that we should discuss unification. It's a conversation that's already happening. People are having this conversation in Northern Ireland and here. We want to be part of it. We want to lead on it. We have a different view of unification than others have, and we want to engage with people who are willing to talk to us about it. Now, I can take on board the criticism that some people have made in relation to the timing.
Do you accept it?
I'm willing to take it on board, but I would say this back, and I think this is important. There are people who will always be uncomfortable talking about the issue of unification. And for them, maybe even some of my own party, it'll always be the wrong time. It was the wrong time for the past 3 or 4 years because of the sensitivity of the Brexit negotiations. It was the wrong time this week because of the problems in the DUP. It'll be the wrong time for the next few months because of the marching season and the protocol. It'll be the wrong time next year because we're running into the Northern Ireland Assembly elections. It'll be the wrong time after that because there will probably be huge difficulties at that point in getting the executive going again. So, you know, there'll never be a right time to have this conversation in the minds of some people. In my view, this conversation has started. It's already underway. It's been had here in RTE, for example. You did a particular special on it only a few weeks ago, which some people criticised for the exact same reasons. But I don't agree with that. I think there's never a bad time to talk about the future.
Just to bring it to the events of this week and what happened in the DUP, the Minister for Foreign Affairs said yesterday that the Irish government was involved in that deal with Brandon Lewis and Edwin Poots and Mary Lou MacDonald to push the Irish language legislation through the UK Parliament. Now, if that deal continues to be a problem for the DUP under its new leader, is that a barrier? If it becomes a barrier to forming an executive, should it then be proceeded with?
Well, you know, a huge amount of work was put in by all of the parties, and also the former Secretary of State Gillian Smith and Minister of Foreign Affairs Simon Coveney in agreeing this new decade, new approach, this NDNA deal. And that deal includes in it the fact that the Assembly and Executive would put in place Irish language legislation, Acht na Gaeilge, something that shouldn't really threaten anyone. It's similar to legislation that exists in Scotland and Wales already. And as part of that, there will be a wider cultural package to recognise the identity of people who are British in Northern Ireland and people coming from a unionist perspective. That was agreed. It was agreed by the governments. It was agreed by all parties. Mm. And that should be honoured. You know, people should honour their agreements.
Okay, but the arrangement now is that it'll either go, if it doesn't go through Stormont, it'll go through Westminster. Do you want that deal to be honoured, even if it's a problem for the DUP?
No, I think what should happen is that all of the parties, including the DUP and Sinn Féin, should honour the commitment that they made not that long ago. You know, this isn't ancient history. The NDNA agreement was made, if I remember correctly, in some cold, dark days in January of last year. And that was an agreement that was made. And, you know, the last leader of the DUP, the outgoing leader of the DUP and the incoming leader of the DUP were all across that agreement. So I don't understand why anyone, no matter what background they come from, wouldn't honour an agreement that they made only a year ago.
If Geoffrey Donaldson, as it is expected, becomes the leader of the DUP and we're into a bargaining period, perhaps to stabilise the Assembly, is there anything on the table regarding the protocol for him?
You know, we understand as a government that the protocol has created some practical difficulties for people and businesses in Northern Ireland, and through the European Union and through negotiations with the British government, we will go the extra mile. We will leave no stone unturned. We'll do everything that we can to make sure that protocol works, to minimise the number of checks and controls, and also to start talking about the advantages of the protocol, this unique position that Northern Ireland has, free access not just to the British market, but also the massive European single market. And this can work and can work well. But that does require engagement. It does require the British government being able to make some concessions. The EU has already made a lot, quite frankly. They haven't been as forthcoming from the British government. But the reason why the protocol is necessary is because of the Brexit that was chosen by the British government with the support of the DUP. And that has led to a situation whereby there have to be checks and controls somewhere. It's our view that it's much better they happen in two or three ports rather than on border posts along 10 border counties. And that was always the issue. And, you know, it's not as if the protocol was some part of an evil design by the Irish government or the European Union. This happened because they rejected the single market, rejected the customs union, rejected the backstop, which would have been a UK-wide solution. That's how we ended up with the protocol. And I think people who are now giving out about it need to be a bit more honest about that.
OK, just finally, before I let you go, you are the leader of your party, but you're also a leader who is under Garda investigation in relation to the leaking of a GP contract. And we know that you have denied any wrongdoing in relation to that. You said earlier on television to my colleague, Áine Lawler, that you would like that matter brought to a conclusion. Do you think now that it has gone on too long, that investigation, is it a distraction for your work?
It's certainly not a distraction for my work. I'm doing my work as I always did. Obviously, I would have preferred if it could be concluded by now, but again, that's not something that I have any control over, and I appreciate that the Gardaí have to do their job. I would say once again that it was not a contract. A contract is a legal document that parties enter into. It was not that. And that's one of the many misreportings that has gone on in relation to this. There was no complaint, by the way, from anybody in the Department of Health. That's another thing that was misreported about this. And the document was not legally protected, not a cabinet confidentiality. But like I say, look, when this investigation is over, I'll have a chance to...
Have you asked the Gardaí when they're likely to reach a conclusion on it?
I haven't. I've heard nothing directly from the Gardaí since Easter. And like I say, wouldn't be appropriate for me to try to interfere in an investigation anyway, and I haven't done that.
All right. Tánaiste and Fine Gael leader Leo Varadkar, thank you for coming to us today.